Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Unlimited Realities. I'm your host, Lisa Zimmer, and today we begin a brand new show format. I'm very, very excited to bring this to you. It has been in my creative mind for about 6 to 9 months now, and it's finally coming to fruition. Please be patient with me as I work through the tweaks that I'm sure I will need to do as we go along. But we have four incredibly wise souls, and we start off our show today. I'm going to first talk about all four guests, and then I'm going to bring on my first guest. And today we're talking and focusing upon the paranormal, how it's viewed, coming out of a male perspective and opening up the right intuitive feminine aspect of the brain, and looking for balance in our lives, looking for that harmony, that peace that we can create through where we put our attention and where we can put our thoughts. Today we are going to enjoy four wonderful guests, like I had said, and we're going to start off our hour with James D. Stein, who wrote The Paranormal Equation. He's both an author and a professor, and he also wrote How Math Explains the World. He's a fascinating man, and he's going to talk to us about the new scientific perspective on remote viewing, clairvoyance, and other inexplicable phenomena. Then we are moving into a little dialogue with Don Mortesini as he talks about, who's also an author, and he is a psychotherapist, and he's going to talk about how the East and the West view paranormal phenomena. And then we are moving into another segment with Charles Eduardo, who is a life transformational coach and inspirational speaker, and he's going to talk about male vulnerability and what that looks like. And we end our segment with Terry Cochran, who is going to be offering us some wisdom and insight as a certified nutritionist, as a health and healthy segment for herbs and food. So without further ado, I bring your attention to my first wonderful guest, and this is James D. Stein, PhD, author of The Paranormal Equation, also author of How Math Explains the World. And as I said, we're going to be discussing how a new scientific perspective is coming to our awareness on remote viewing and clairvoyance. So welcome, James Stein. I am so very, very happy to have you on my show today. Welcome,
Lisa. Thank you so
much
for inviting me on your show.
This is wonderful. I loved your book. I love the combination of science and mysticism. And this is, you know, you take for someone who is probably raised with such an analytical perspective, you really do combine the intuitive perspective so geniusly in your book. You have such a weaving that I just love to read. And without further ado, let's get into this math as the universal language. We hear this so many times, that math is the universal language of the world, and I tend to believe that. But why do you think that is, in regard to certain scientists that have been pioneers in the study of patterns and numbers, and why would we look at math in that way?
Well, I think that it is true that math is a universal language, but I don't think it's the universal language, in that there's stuff that math simply doesn't explain. What math is really good at is it's dealing with stuff that can be measured, or which you can ascribe certain objective qualities to, like shape and things like that. And because our universe consists so much of relationships between things that can be measured or things that have shapes and change into different shapes, that's, I think, the reason that mathematics is so effective in expressing and dealing with these quantities of the universe. But it's just not perfect in dealing with everything. There are limitations to math, as there are limitations to all forms of knowledge.
Right. Now, what scientists were instrumental in looking at the patterns and numbers as something that should be explored more in regard to phenomena?
Well, I think you could probably say that of practically every science that deals with measurement, because if you take a look at what are the great laws that science has discovered, and we're talking about things like Newton's law of universal gravitation or Einstein's theory of relativity or Maxwell's theories of electromagnetism, they're expressed in terms of quantities and their relationships to each other. And it usually requires a lot of work on the part of many members of the scientific community to arrive at a theory which expresses these relationships. And you sort of get the impression when you take a course in science or when you look at one of the TV shows discussing these things that these people are sort of like Beethoven's or Picasso's, and all of a sudden inspiration comes to them. And it does in some sense, but it's a more linear process than that. It's a matter of putting together all the arduous experiments that have gone into trying to see what happens when you do something to something. That's the basic experiment, started maybe with Galileo when he rolled balls down an inclined plane and tried to see how they picked up speed and measured how long it took them to get from one place to another in order to see if they changed their velocities and if he could find a pattern to it. And Kepler, who was one of the great astrologers of his day, believe it or not, looked for patterns in the orbits of the planets about the sun and tried to figure out how that could be fit into some sort of universal pattern. So this is basically what science, or at least the quantitative sciences, is about.
Okay. Now, what did what would you say is the borderline between a natural phenomenon and a supernatural phenomenon?
That's an extremely good question, because there's a difficulty with saying what is supernatural when, if you take a look at our past history, things that are natural to us would have been supernatural to generations before. Certainly the mere fact that you and I are talking from one end of the continent to another, or we can look at TV and see pictures that come from practically anywhere, would have appeared to be supernatural to someone from the 15th century. So what happens is that science tends to push back the domain of the supernatural. But I think the really interesting question is, are there things that we will never know? And not only are there things that we will never know, but things that we would expect science to be able to explain to us, things like relationships between the physical parameters that we measure, such as mass, length, time, energy, force, information. Are there relationships between this that are going to be forever unknown, not because we just haven't enough time to investigate it, but because in some sense we simply cannot access this knowledge? And I think that's where the supernatural lies, in knowledge that we cannot access. And it's only in the 20th century that we were able to establish that there really is such a thing as knowledge that we cannot access.
Okay. And that brings me to a question that I'd love to hear your perspective on. In regard to dark matter and dark energy, what is this, and how is this relevant?
Well, I think it's relevant because what we've discovered, startlingly enough, in the last 20 years or 30 years, is that the universe that we thought we know, we only really know 5% of it. Dark matter is sort of a pat name for matter that we know exists because it affects the rotation rates of stars and galaxies, but we can't detect it, or at least we haven't detected yet. It's dark to all our instruments. We can't see it. Our X-ray detectors don't pick it up. Our gamma ray detectors don't pick it up. Our microwave detectors don't pick it up. So far it's dark and we don't know what it is. And dark energy is even more startling because approximately 11 or 12 years ago, we discovered that the universe is actually accelerating in its expansion. Rather than slowing down as you might expect, it's expanding ever more rapidly, and this expansion is due to something that we call dark energy, simply because we have no idea what it is. I think it was described to be dark energy simply because we already had the idea of dark matter, and this was an energy and it formed a natural linguistic pair, dark matter, dark energy. But the startling thing is that the universe turns out to consist of about 5% ordinary matter and energy, 20% dark matter, and the rest dark energy. In other words, we don't know what 95% of the energy is. It's a great, and 95% of the stuff in the universe. And that's a great mystery. And until that mystery is solved, there are things that, you know, that we want to say about the universe that we're absolutely stymied.
Right. That's incredible. What, do you feel that parallel universes exist somewhere within this matter, or if that's going to be something that scientists are able to prove at some point?
Oh, I certainly do, and I think an awful lot of scientists believe that parallel universes exist. And they can exist in one of several ways. There's, I would recommend to your readers and your listeners that if they want to go on the internet and Google a man named Max Tegmark, T-E-G-M-A-R-K. He wrote an absolutely beautiful article on parallel universes for Scientific American back in 2003. And basically he makes clear that it's orthodox scientific thinking in a number of ways that parallel universes exist. And he describes it very, very matter-of-factly by saying, because it was an article that he wrote in a magazine. He said that at this moment, a long distance from you, there's a person exactly like you sitting in a chair reading exactly the same article that you are, and the only difference between you and him is that when you get to this sentence, you continue reading, and he stops and goes off and gets a cup of coffee. It's very orthodox scientific thinking to believe in parallel universes.
Wow, that's incredible. So actually, there is going to most likely be some revealings in the next century that has befuddled all of us for many centuries, is what you say.
I think that's the history of all the sciences, and it's actually the history of all knowledge. I mean, I think that,
right.
I think that science, you know, we tend to see science advance and can measure it more accurately simply because, number one, is it's easier to put the laws of science down than, say, the laws of human interaction. It's much easier to measure temperature or electricity than it is to measure wisdom or compassion. So that means that science has a leg up simply because it deals with stuff that's a lot easier to measure, number one. And number two is that there's a huge payoff in learning about the universe. We can make lives better for ourselves. You look at everything that exists today. I mean, I don't know about you, but I would far rather be me, a relatively ordinary math professor living in a suburb of Los Angeles in the year 2013, than I would have liked to have been the richest person in the world in the year 1900, because if you were the richest person in the world in 1900, your life expectancy wouldn't have been so great. A trip to the dentist would have been agonizing, and what could you do for entertainment other than see an occasional play, listen to some music, or read a book?
Right. Good point. That's a great point. Would you say that science is looking into the aspect of ghosts or apparitions or spirits to see if they actually do exist? And what do you think science would say about that if they did prove that?
Well, there have been instances in which legitimate scientists, and when I think of legitimate scientists, I think of people who have, you know, solid scientific credentials, have looked into such a thing as spirituality, ghosts, after death experiences. But I think part of the difficulty is that you can't measure or describe these things objectively as well as you can much of the stuff that science deals with, things like temperature and electricity. So, but I think that, you know, that the study of ghosts is not performed by scientists generally at the moment for a really simple reason. There's no money in it. Scientists, like everybody else, need to eat. They need to put a roof over their heads. And they also need expensive equipment. And the people who usually put money up for scientists to work are governments and corporations. And if you were to ask a government, well, suppose that a scientist discovered that ghosts are a reality, how's it going to help the government, you know, how's it going to help them, the politicians who funded it, get elected? And if you ask a corporation to put up money to study it, what product are they going to produce that they're going to sell? They'd much rather investigate things such as cure for cancer or cheaper sources of energy, which are going to do everybody some good. But one thing I do feel fairly certain of, if ghosts are ever shown to be a reality in the same way that electricity or temperature or something like that is a reality, or even the social sciences, the realities that we deal with in psychology and sociology and things like that, if ghosts ever achieve that level of reality, there'll be departments of ghostology in the science departments of major universities, because scientists love to study reality. That's their thing. Mm-hmm. But you got to show them that it really is reality first.
Right, right. And do you feel like science will become more tolerant of unscientific viewpoints as we move along here?
Well, yes and no, because science is a human endeavor, and mm-hmm. there's usually an establishment in every human endeavor, even the intellectual ones such as science. And what happens is the people who are at the top of the heap have gotten to the top of the heap because they have a particular viewpoint, and when you challenge that viewpoint, what happens is that you're essentially going up against the top guns in the field. And the people who are established want to preserve their standing. So because it's a human enterprise, there's still going to be a certain amount of intolerance. And in a way, that intolerance is beneficial to the world as a whole, because in order for something to be established as scientific knowledge, it's got to pass some pretty rigorous tests. And that's good for us, because it means that you can build on these things. It's sort of like, you know, it's sort of like designing a new type of airplane. They now do that all by computers, and you don't really have to fly actual airplanes to know that they're going to fly, because the theory is sufficiently good that you can design it on a computer and be pretty sure that it's not going to crash when you take it off. And this is a tremendous advance, and it's the type of thing that science relies upon. When you have solid knowledge, you can build upon it. So even though there will always be challenges to the status quo, and I think that's true of any human endeavor, and it's beneficial that there are challenges, because otherwise science becomes dogma rather than the pursuit of knowledge. But the fact is that, you know, the fact is that because the people who are at the top are human beings, they like being at the top, they got to the top by espousing certain ideas which have proven to be true. If you challenge them, you're going to have to be right. But if you are right, they're going to accept you, and you're going to be the new members of the establishment.
Right. And how would you say that precognition and psychokinesis is different from ESP and telepathy and even clairvoyance?
Well, I think the difficulty is precognition runs into the difficulty that there are logical problems associated with it. If you think you get a message from the future, you could take an action which would invalidate that. Like, let's say you got a message that you were going to have a traffic accident on a freeway tomorrow night. So you stay off that particular road, you don't have a traffic accident. You've invalidated the message. So that's a logical problem that precognition has to overcome. And as for psychokinesis, in order to move stuff or do anything on the psychokinetic front, you run into various physical laws that require forces. And the forces that we know, gravity and electromagnetism and the nuclear forces, those are ones which have been well studied, and they deteriorate with distance. They weaken with distance. And mental forces presumably don't, and we haven't detected them yet. They may exist. It's possible, but as of yet, there's no definitive evidence. As for ESP and telepathy, ESP, surprisingly enough, there was a study done of college professors in the 1990s, and more than 50% of the science professors believed that ESP was either an established reality or very likely. And I don't know of a similar study that has been done for telepathy, but my personal feeling, and this is just a personal feeling, is that at some time in the future, telepathy will be achieved mechanically, if nothing else, simply because when we think about things, electrochemical patterns form in our brains. These influence the surrounding environment, even if minutely, and we're getting better and better detectors, and they'll be able to pick up these changes in the environment. And then it's a matter of finding the Rosetta Stone, which associates these changes with the thoughts in our brain. But at the start of your show, you talked about right-brained people and left-brained people. We didn't know that until we had neuroscience and the technology to investigate what the association was between left-brain thinkers and right-brain thinkers. And as our technology gets better, we'll get better at associating various portions of the brain with specific thoughts and thought patterns.
Right, and that's also coming out of a very masculine-based thinking and the analytical thought, because it's always inspiring to me when I start to see the balance of incorporating both hemispheres, because I do believe that both are needed for the balance of our being and the world, and I really appreciate that work that you do. Jim, it has been a wonderful segment to have you on as my guest. This has been really so inspiring. Where can my listeners get a hold of you? Or I want to also mention your book again, The Paranormal Equation. It is by James D. Stein, Ph.D. He is also the author of How Math Explains the World. He is author and professor, and he is... This is found on Amazon, is that right?
That's right. Jim? I mean, practically any book that's ever been written can be found on Amazon. But they can get in touch with me by emailing me, because I'm a paid employee of the state of California, and basically I'm paid to answer questions. So if you go to the website for California State University, Long Beach, go to the math department. There's only one Stein, that's me. There's an email address. And I've always said, if somebody asks me a question, if I know the answer, I'll tell them. If I think I know the answer, I'll tell them that I think I know the answer. If I only have an opinion, I'll tell them that. And if I'm clueless, I'll tell them that too.
Wonderful. Jim, you have been a blessing of a guest. Thank you so much for being my guest today. I wish you a wonderful new 2013, and God bless. Thank you so much for bringing this insight to our attention today.
Lisa, thank you for inviting me again.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Take
care. Bye-bye. Now we're moving into my next segment, which is a second segment, and our guest now is Don Mortesini. And Don is the author of Princes and Ogres, and he is also going to talk to us about how we look at the paranormal from the West versus how the paranormal is viewed from the East. And I would like to bring your attention now to my next guest, Don Mortesini, psychotherapist and author of Princes and Ogres. Don, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Oh, it's great. You know, Lisa, it's great to just be on your show again. I just love it. And I really enjoyed the professor and made some notes on what he said. I'm just excited to get going.
Oh, thank you so much. You are always such a light. I love talking to you. You're such a you integrate such integrity with your work, and I truly, truly value that. So let's talk a little bit about the East and the West viewpoints.
Okay, yeah. I want to start with a statement he made, and he said that you know, 95% of the universe is a mystery. And he asked him about studying paranormal phenomena, and he said, yes, but there are great difficulties, and we can only go so far. And
right.
That is because they use physical instruments of some kind to measure, and they're working with their intellect. And so what you and I are going to be talking about is not about using the intellect, but putting the intellect on hold, quieting the intellect so that we can delve into consciousness. And,
wonderful.
And so to begin with, in the East, starting 600 years B.C., the very first philosopher that developed a monism, that is the concept of just one God, you know, may have different faces, it doesn't matter, Jesus, Jehovah, whatever, monism, his name was Kapila. And every philosopher, every thinker from that time forward in the East never made a distinction between something that is solid, between matter and spirit. So in the East, there is just two phenomena, if you will, and that is consciousness and energy. Everything is consciousness and energy. So what we call God is penultimate, infinite consciousness, and of course, infinite energy. And your guest, you know, the professor is wonderful, will tell you that your eyes deceive you. Lisa, you and I are not solid beings. You know, basically, we're subatomic structures with a nucleus and some subparticles that appear and disappear and a vast amount of space. And it's a different configuration of all of these things that that we perceive as a vase or as a table or whatever. And so basically, they say that God is ultimate consciousness, and we are individual units of consciousness and individual units of energy. So we're like waves on the ocean of consciousness and energy. And the more that we develop our consciousness and go beyond our own consciousness, we begin to step into more and more of that infinite consciousness. And that's where the difference is between the East and the West. There is no bifurcation that takes place. So I don't know if this answers your question or not.
Yeah, it actually does, because how we view things is pretty much colored by how we've been reared, and the culture from the West is a very short time frame compared to other cultures like in India or Asia or even in the Middle East. We have cultures of thousands of years, and here in America we have a 200-year culture. So it's, you know, we're kind of limited.
Well, you know, the thing is, like they say, paranormal. Para in Sanskrit means higher. So you and I, and I think most of your listeners have heard of the great autobiography yogi Paramahansa Yogananda. Well, Paramahansa is man in Sanskrit. So Paramahansa is the great mind yogi. Paramahansa Yogananda is the great yogi of bliss. That's how his name translates into English. So he was this great yogi of bliss. So para means higher or higher consciousness. So it's an extension of normal consciousness. As we expand our consciousness, we go into higher levels of consciousness, and that's where you find what each calls the so-called paranormal phenomena. Anyway, so let me just stop there and see where you want to take that one.
Okay, so in regard to the paranormal phenomenon, there's also where they will go and request to see a siddha. And where can you talk to us about a little bit about what that is and how?
Okay, this a siddha again. The translation from Sanskrit from siddha just means power.
Okay.
It just means a power, a special power. Okay. And as you delve beneath as you deepen your own spiritual consciousness, you begin to move into the ocean of consciousness of God. And God is is, as we used to say in Christianity and Catholicism, is omniscient, knows everything, is composite of all knowledge that ever was and ever will be. Okay.
Okay.
And so as we drop into that, then some people are born with a little bit of a gift to be able to foretell the future or things like this. And basically what that is, that's a siddha that came to them. I believe that the siddha and the paranormal experiences that we see, life after death experiences, things like this, are to shake us up, that we do not live in just a linear material reality. And so we have these great stories of people who have survived after their heart has been stopped, or people who can read the future and nail it. And this is all to show us that we have to get beyond this linear perspective, limited perspective, what life is about. Now, as one deepens one's consciousness, the siddhas have been listed, and they're known, and they've been enumerated. And some of them are, you know, the ability to see the future. Another is levitation. You know, as an old Catholic, you and I remember pictures of St. Francis, you know, floating in a cloud. Mm-hmm. Well, why did a painter do that? Well, what happened, he would get so absorbed in his merger, in his spiritual marriage with God, that all of a sudden the siddha would open and he'd just be floating. And so basically there are a great number of siddhas or special powers, the power to bilocate, to leave one's body. All that one happens is one goes into one's energy field, which is called the etheric field or the astral field, okay, and bilocates. And this has been done for centuries and centuries. And so as one goes into the deeper levels of consciousness, these gifts or these powers, which is what siddha means, these powers are there. Now, the idea is not to use them unless you're going to use them for the benefit of the spiritual growth of mankind. Otherwise, the ego takes it over. Look, I can levitate. Look, I can tell what's going to happen to you tomorrow. Because the ego will grab anything and run to the goalpost with it.
Right. And where can we stop ourselves in that mindset? Because there's a mindfulness that we can adopt in regard to catching ourselves and catching our thoughts. So would you have a suggestion for our audience?
Well, the thing is, you have to be on your toes all the time.
Yeah.
Well, let me give you an example. You know, I wrote the book Princes and Ogres, Integration of Psyche and Soul. This came from a deep place within me, from love, to share the love of my knowledge of consciousness through meditating for 40 years and all my experiences to help people. This was a pure intent. This was an intent of spirit. This was an intent that came from my heart. Okay. Now,
As I
got a publicist got me radio shows and got articles written, everything, all my ego says, oh, well, look at that article done. Oh, look at this. Oh, look at those book sales there. Ego took the whole goddamn thing over. I'm sorry to talk like that on the phone. It's like I'm pulling the ego back. This is not what it's about. It's not what it's about. The ego will creep into spirituality. So anytime it says me, look at me, look at me, look what I've done, look what I've done, you are an ego. And you've got to center yourself and say, wait a minute. As I do that, I cut off my spirituality. As I do that, I cut off my ability to plumb the depths of consciousness and continually deepen into love, compassion, the desire to heal and help mankind, and all of those qualities of the soul. And the ego will grab them in a minute. So I say you have to be on your toes all the time.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much, Don. It has been a pleasure listening to your wisdom and philosophy and guiding us to open our minds and our hearts and our souls here. Again, Don Mortesini, his book is Princes and Ogres, and you can also find that on Amazon, and he is a wonderful psychotherapist and author. I just absolutely love vibing with you, Don. Thank you so much for being on my show today. God bless you, and have a great week.
That's a treat. I love you, Lisa. Have a wonderful
day. I love you
too,
Don. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Now we're going to be moving into our third segment with a wonderful soul, Charles Edwardos. And Charles is a life transformational coach and inspirational and motivational speaker. You can find information on his mentoring and life coaching programs at victoriousliving system.com. And I'm going to spell that out because it's a mouthful. It's Victorious, VictorIous, living, LIVING, system, SYSTEM.com. Victorious Living System. And he has written Free to Be Me, Breaking the Macho Male Paradigm, Male Vulnerability, and What Does That Look Like? That's what we're talking about today. And so we have Charles Edwardes, our life transformational coach and inspirational speaker now. Charles, thank you so much for being my guest today on Unlimited Realities. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. I'm on with some heavy hitters. Holy smokes. I'm in the big leagues now.
Well, you know, it's all about wisdom. And the thing is that we all have little bits of wisdom within us, and it's just bringing it to the light and letting it be, you know, absorbed by whomever it resonates with. And so I'm really, really grateful to have you on today to really talk about what does male vulnerability look like. We're kind of focusing on, you know, the evolving male today. We're looking at male well-being, the body, mind, soul, and we really want to look at, you know, stepping out of the male perspective, incorporating more of the feminine intuitiveness, and then that opens up a whole can of worms for the man because they're not used to feeling so soft and emotional. So what does this look like?
Yeah, it's and you know what, when you first approached me about this, and who came to mind is a gentleman that I have so much respect for, and that is the late General Norman Schwarzkopf.
Oh, yeah.
When I remember watching at the conclusion of Desert Storm when he was addressing his troops, and he got a little emotional. And he teared up. And I remember, I forget who it was, but the reporter looked at him and said, yeah, well, you know, you were talking to your people there and you got emotional. Explain to us, General, how can all these troops trust a man who would get emotional like that? And he looked that reporter square in the eye and said, I wouldn't trust a man who couldn't cry. I think
great
statement. It was phenomenal, and I love what Don was just talking about dropping into, and that's what Free to Be Me, dropping into the authentic self, which is so contrary to all of the things. And I believe it came up when you were talking to Dr. Stein. The idea of how we are conditioned. I think you were talking about how we are conditioned in our childhood.
Right.
Around beliefs and values, and this is the way it is. And we probably have all heard that at one time or another from both of our parents and adults. This is the real world. This is the way it really is. Well, is it?
Right.
And see, I have a couple of clients that call me Morpheus because I gave them the blue pill and I'm showing them how deep the rabbit hole goes. but
it's opening the perspective, you know. It's changing that old paradigm, you know.
That's it. It's the world that has been pulled over our eyes. But is it the real world? And having been a police officer for 10 years myself, worked undercover in narcotics, trained by the FBI as a hostage negotiator, when I believe, in my own experience, when a man is able to find that place of balance and allow more of that right brain sensitivity that is generally associated with the feminine side, It can only prove to serve you really well in a sensitivity, in an intuitive type of a knowing. And I think a lot of guys probably use it without realizing that they're using it.
Right. I've actually found a lot of men use it instinctively in business because intuitively they tap into their business decision-making and they don't realize that it's actually connecting their analytical and their intuitive together. So I bring this to the awareness with my clients, and it's all of a sudden this aha moment. It's like, wow, I've been intuitive my whole life. I mean,
right.
It's like,
right.
Yes, intuitive right. is you. That is who you are. That's every being
exactly.
who walks.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so you know, those that aspect, when it's triggered by a male or it's starting to come to the surface of male awareness, it does tend to trigger a tremendous amount of emotions in men. And sometimes they don't know how to interpret these emotions or what these emotions mean or where they're coming from. So, you know, I loved that story where, you know, one of the biggest, toughest A-type personality man in our country cried.
Yes.
And he said,
yes.
You know, and he said, hey, you know, this is real. This is real human emotion. There's loss of
yes.
life, you know, let's
yes.
get real. So,
yes.
The, you know, the fact that is something that we can look at and we don't have to shy away from in our culture now, that men don't have to be brave and stoic and not feel the emotion, that, you know, they can cry when they're in pain or they're triggered or they're touched, because we're
yes.
all human.
And, exactly right.
And, you know, you're providing such an incredible service by mentoring men specifically to embrace a side of their personality that's always existed, but, you know, isn't typically supported in male society. So you're free to be me, you know, breaking the old male paradigm.
Yeah.
That is wonderful. That's an incredibly wonderful gift that you're providing the world. So do you want to talk a little bit about that in the last few minutes we have here?
Well, that is actually one aspect, and the free to be me is actually even broader than that. As a matter of fact, this Saturday morning, I'm speaking at the main campus of Cleveland Clinic Hospital, and I'm speaking to a group of young people around this whole thing. And part of it is, Lisa, just as you well know, just the whole idea of the meaning frames and the
mm-hmm.
beliefs that we inherited, not that we created ourselves, but to I love the Science Channel. They say question everything, and that's where I'm at. Question, why do I believe this? What do I believe? What do I believe a man is? What
right.
makes a man? And to look at those things, I think it's most important to be authentically who you are. Imagine your life if you had nothing to fear, nothing to lose, nothing to hide, and nothing to prove.
Wow.
That's freedom. That's freedom right there.
That's true. That's freedom. That's peace. That's peace of mind. And
freedom
very elusive. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
elusive in the context of our society, if we get caught up in our society's, you know, chaotic structure. But
exactly.
very, very doable when we are mindful to keep it intact.
Exactly right. So I love what I do, and I'm right now actually working on a couple of things where we're going to be providing some online situations, because I've had a number of people outside of the northeastern Ohio area where I'm physically located that have voiced some interest. So we're going to be trying to broaden our horizons here to make what I am so excited about more accessible to more people through the marvels of modern technology.
Wonderful, wonderful. Because that's, you know, the more that you can touch in a natural walk of life that isn't like that aren't already embracing alternative thought or approaches or spirituality or body mind spirit approaches, the more that you can target and focus upon the average soul and awareness, the more opening that becomes, the more enlightening that generates to each person they in fact touch. So look at this with you going to the Cleveland Clinic this weekend and how many children are going to be affected, and then bouncing that back off of whomever they connect with within their families and loved ones. That's wonderful.
Exactly. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Lisa, thank you for what you do. Thank you for what you do in just getting the light out there and some of the wonderful guests that you have. I've been an admirer from the distance here for a while, and again, I'm just honored to be on your program today.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today. I truly, truly have appreciated you. I've loved vibing with you. You've been a very easy, wonderful, informative guest, and we'll have to have some more chat sessions in the future. How about it?
Look forward to it.
Great. And everybody, I want to bring your attention again to Charles Eduardos and his life transformational coaching and inspirational speaker and motivational speaker. I want to bring you to victoriouslivingsystem.com. And he has both Free to Be Me and Breaking the Macho Men Paradigm. Thank you again, Charles. God bless you, and God bless your work and all that you do. And thank you for being my guest today. It has truly been a gift.
Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome. Many blessings. Bye-bye.
Back to you. Bye-bye.
Okay, now we are going to be finishing up our last segment as soon as Terry Cochran calls into the studio. And we are going to be finishing up with Terry Cochran is a certified nutritionist. And she actually wrote a book focusing upon some really incredible gourmet recipes. And if you know me at all, you know I do love to cook really, really good food. Fresh, organic, healthy, yummy, tasty, and often spicy food. So Terry had created this wonderful cookbook, and I had her on as a guest. I guess it was probably a year ago. And she's coming on today. In fact, she just lit up in my little studio board here. And we're going to bring Terry on. And Terry is a certified nutritionist. And she's also a master herbalist and gourmet chef. And we're just going to add that on because she just is. But we are going to have Terry talk to us about male health and focusing upon, you know, a lot of times in middle age, male health is something that men tend to not really address and talk about. They get their, you know, wives worried and they avoid the doctors. And a lot of times, you know, there's these little tweaks that need to happen as we all get older, God forbid. Well, it's a blessing because what's the alternative, right? But we have to tweak things. We have to eat better. We have to take better care of ourselves. And part of this is knowing what to eat and what to avoid. So without further ado, I am going to introduce my fourth guest today, Terry Cochran, certified nutritionist. Terry, thank you so much for being my guest today. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Lisa. So good to be back.
It is wonderful having you. I'm so looking forward to your wisdom today on our little health tip, food insight, and male wonderment. So I'm going to give you the floor. You can tell us, what did you bring us here today?
Well, you know, as we talk about male evolution, I really am thinking about what is happening to male hormones today. And what we are seeing is that the average American consumes 5 pounds of pesticides every year through their food supply.
Wow.
And those pesticides are actually turning into xenoestrogens. Xenoestrogens is a man-made chemical that mimics the worst kind of estrogen. And we are seeing now males, especially young males, developing breast buds. I live in the metro Washington, D.C. area. Our Chesapeake Bay is finding that our fish are becoming hermaphroditic, meaning that the male fish are starting to develop female parts.
Wow.
So that is very scary for everyone, but especially children and the population. So one of the things that I really want to emphasize today is to really be aware of the estrogens in your food supply, whether they come from pesticides that convert to xenoestrogens, whether they come from soy. Soy now is the number two crop grown in the United States.
90%. Wow.
Yes, it is. It's no longer something that we get at a health food place.
Right.
And 90% of it is genetically modified. So what that means is we are taking the wonderful phytoestrogens from soy, pairing it with the genetically modified seed that contains pesticides, which then turn to xenoestrogens. And so what we're getting is what I'm calling kryptonite soy. It has an overabundance of estrogen, the majority of it being the bad kind, which is the xenoestrogen. And so what does that mean for men's health? It means that when estrogen in our male bodies go up, testosterone goes down. Yes, it's an inversely related proportional hormone balance. And so when that happens, then the virility decreases. Estrogen is also a cell proliferator. So prostate health may be impacted. So it's very scary. Estrogen has become a real scary deal for us because we're so estrogen dominant due to our food supply being estrogen dominant, our soy, our pesticides, the nitrogen runoff that goes into our water, which then, again, goes into our drinking system and therefore estrogen. So how do we manage that? Well, the best way to manage estrogen dominance is to clear it. And how do we clear it? Well, we have to have our detoxifying organs working in optimal order. What are those? Primarily our liver and our kidneys. How do we detoxify? Well, certain foods help detoxify. And a particular group of foods, those that are from the cruciferous family of vegetables, being cabbage, broccoli, bok choy, arugula, watercress, kale, have a component called indole-3-carbinol. And why is that so important? One, it's been definitively proven by scientists at Wayne State University that it arrests cancer cells, prostate cancer cells in particular.
Really?
But another thing that is so important about indole-3-carbinol is that it is an estrogen metabolizer, and it is a wonderful source of L-glutamine, which helps in the liver detoxification pathway, so therefore clearing our liver. So when we eat cruciferous vegetables, we're getting this trifecta of incredible health benefits. We're getting the indole-3-carbinol, which is cancer arresting. We're getting the L-glutamine, which is so important for phase two liver detoxification pathway. And we're getting a host of phytonutrients and chlorophyll, which alkalize the body. And alkalization is important for optimal immune function because our standard American diet is acidic in nature. So what do we have to do? We have to alkalize our bodies to help with immune function and reducing that inflammatory response.
You are amazing. You are simply amazing, Terry. I am taking notes here, and I'm going to have to re-listen to you so I can take all the little vegetables I need to go buy at the farmer's market. This is really wonderful information because there does seem to be an increase in hormonal imbalances, and not only in the female, but also in men. I'm seeing it within clients. I'm seeing it with family members, and it's very alarming because you never used to hear about this. And you know, andropause is not something that's often talked about. You hear about menopause for women, but you never hear about andropause with men going through their own emotional hormonal shifts and changes in midlife. And I'm sure that is really affected by these xenoestrogens that are found in the foods. I mean, that's got to really...
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. I do see a lot of males in their 50s that are going through andropause, and what we are seeing is that, indeed, their estrogen levels are elevated, and therefore their testosterone levels are lowered. And therefore, their DHEA levels are lowered, which is the anti-aging hormone. And then when you add stress to the picture, cortisol goes up. Therefore, when cortisol goes up, we get that middle belly fat.
Right.
And midlife, you know, in its full vibrancy, there you go. Unfortunately, that's the product of our standard American diet, but we don't have to be one of those.
We
can really reverse this, and we can help ourselves even as we mature and we age. We can age in a very healthful way.
Good, because that's my aim. That is my goal. I am seeking to age gracefully. That is my goal. But where can we look in regard to, as we move through our food sources, what can we do to really emphasize more of healthy vegetables? I mean, is it really indicative of we have to go to farmers markets, we have to buy organic? It pretty much is, isn't it?
Well, I think what I always tell my clients is get to know your grocer, ask them where they source their products, and then go to the CSAs or your local farmers markets and ask them how they grow their foods. But I really believe that it is a product of our generation that has just gotten used to convenience foods that shop inside the package instead of looking for the brilliant colors that come from nature. And so as we get back to our roots, literally, and those being root vegetables, and those that come from nature, all the vegetables that spring forth from Earth's bounty, we get closer to what we need to help balance all of our systems, not just our endocrine system, but all of our organ systems. So it is an educational process, but it's really getting back to understanding the power of nutrition and the power of its value as it relates to a body in balance or a body out of balance. And sadly, we have really moved away from nature, and the results are heart disease, diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, prostate health, endocrine imbalance, thyroid cancer is now the number one fastest growing cancer in the country, and it does not discriminate male, female, or age.
Wow.
Why? Because thyroid is one of the glands that is most sensitive to chemicals.
Oh, gosh. You know, what can we do in regard to thyroid? Are there certain foods we can increase or avoid? Or, I mean,
yes.
You know, thyroid health seems like it's the major, you know, metabolizer, the main dude there that's holding it together in a lot of ways.
It is the main dude, and we're seeing a lot of men with thyroid issues. So one of the best sources is sea salt, Himalayan sea salt, because we have lowered our iodine levels by 40% over the last 40 years, and iodine is integral to thyroid function, as is selenium. Well, where can we get selenium from? We get them from our fish. It's a wonderful source of selenium. Another one is zinc, again, back to shellfish. So you got to go to the sea. You know, for thyroid, it's all about the sea. And then also making sure that if you're buying fish, it truly is coming from the sea and it's not being farm-raised. Because, again, now these fish that are farm-raised are being fed corn and they're being fed food dyes. So they can look pretty.
No kidding.
No, that's true. They're feeding the salmon pink dye, and they're starting to look to genetically modify salmon.
No kidding.
Okay.
So even fish farming is not cool. It's not like you're getting a more organic fish or a healthier fish. It's not.
Nope, it's not cool. And I will say that if you do have to buy farm raised, that and I don't have any specific affiliation with Whole Foods, but they have the highest standards for clean farm fishing.
Okay. I don't have a Whole Foods by me, but hear that, audience. Whole Foods, they will check with your Whole Foods fisher man, dude, guy, butcher guy there. Well, this has been so informative. I have notes all over the place here from you, so I am going to go back and listen to this. Anything else you would like to add? Where can our audience tap in to connect with you and your name of your book and just, you know, let it rip there, Terry.
Absolutely. My book actually is, and my recipe book is loaded with cruciferous vegetables for that very reason that I stated earlier. It's multiple benefits for both men, women, and children. And you can purchase that through my website, which is www.healingpathsva.com. I also have a blog. I have a Facebook page. I'm on Twitter. If you just Google my name, Terry Cochran, you will get to me. And I try to blog almost daily. I'll be blogging about our show today. But it's a really great source of information. And, again, I am getting the word out. And I just recently finished a three-month lecture series with Virginia Hospital Center. So now even doctors and nurses are interested in what I have to say and how my practice runs. So it's very exciting.
Wonderful. This is a very exciting time because as I'm learning and as I'm aware of talking to all you wonderfully wise people, the world is becoming, you know, scientific thought, intellectual thought, you know, stoic thought is starting to open up. The minds are starting to accept alternative approaches, alternative concepts, alternative perspectives. So there's hope here. You know, we're not stuck into complete control, but we do have to be smarter than the average you know, grosser and ask and inquire and be aware of what we're putting in our bodies.
Absolutely. And if we demand it as a population, the grocers
yes.
have to shift their way of producing food. If we stop buying the food that they're putting on the shelves, then they're going to
yes.
stop putting that food on the shelf and start putting the food on the shelf that we're demanding. So
Amen.
It really is a grassroots effort. And I always say, you know, vote with your grocery dollar.
That's right. And it's
eating.
True. It's true. Look at how it's shifted already.
Yes.
Terry, thank
you
so much.
We're already, the momentum is there.
It is. Thank you so much, Terry, for being my guest today. You have been a wealth of information. I look forward to having